You're listening to GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers, now available on iTunes and all other podcast platforms, with new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. GDA Podcast showcases insightful conversations from the best thought leaders, educators, policy experts, motivators, and storytellers on the keynote speaking circuit today. Want today's guest at your next event? Call GDA Speakers at 214-420-1999 or visit gdaspeakers.com. And now, here's this episode of GDA Podcast with hosts Scale and Kyle Davis. Enjoy.
Mike Walsh is a futurist and the author of the best-selling book, The Dictionary of Dangerous Ideas. He is also CEO of the global innovation research agency, Tomorrow. Constantly traveling the world in search of the next big thing, Mike advises Fortune 500 companies on digital transformation and algorithmic leadership. Mike previously founded Jupiter Research in Australia and has also held senior strategy roles at News Corporation in Asia. Mike's books are quite unique and, like his talks, very visual. His best-selling book, Futuretainment, published by Fandon, was the winner of the Design Award by the Art Directors Club in New York. Mike Walsh is our guest on today's episode of GDA Podcast, and he will take our listeners on a whirlwind ride into the world of tomorrow. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
It's very good to be on your wonderful show.
Well, I hear an accent. Where are you from?
That is probably the most difficult question you could ask.
Intentionally so.
I am significantly mixed up. I was born in Australia. That was the easy part. But I grew up on an island in Fiji. I went to school in London. My mother is from Malaysia, but she's Chinese. And, well, my dad's Irish. That's the easy part.
Oh, the joys of being a mutt. It's fun.
We've come a long way.
It's hybrid vigor.
And for people who don't know this, we actually, all three of us, hung out in Sydney in, 2012?
I think that was right.
For the New Year's. So.
That was wonderful.
That was fun.
You just called me up because you wanted someone to help you buy a didgeridoo.
There you go.
We did. We wanted someone to buy us a didgeridoo and to get us close to Kylie Minogue, who was performing on a boat in the middle of Sydney Harbor. Oh, well, whatever.
So how do we dive into this? I guess maybe just starting with that wonderful background and how it led you into this specialization and focus on the future. Maybe bring us up to speed on how you got to this point.
Well, I think futurism is one of these strange jobs that I'm sure no child ever intends on being. In fact, you know, I like, you know, many people that end up in strange jobs started off by being a failed lawyer. I trained as a lawyer. I went to work at McKinsey for a little bit and all these management consulting firms. But, you know, when I joined the workforce, it was the late 90s. And pretty much if you weren't involved in the internet, the first internet boom, you were really living a very dull life. So I had internet companies and, you know, towards the end of that, I met one of the Murdochs in a bar. And ended up doing strategy for News Corporation in Australia and also throughout Asia. And it was a very fortunate time to be doing that because I got to travel all throughout Southeast Asia and Korea and China. And this was before the iPhone. But what I saw in those markets was something extraordinary. I saw a world that would soon come to the West, which was a world that was totally mobile and totally digital. So that experience really convinced me that I should immediately quit my job, I should write a book, and I should do the worst possible thing, which is to become a speaker.
Now, why do you say the worst possible thing?
Well, I'm always a bit nervous telling people I'm a speaker because I'm reminded of that old adage that you know, people that can do and that people that can't teach.
So when we unpack the term futurist or futurism, there's a lot of different avenues and ways that people approach it. What's kind of your underpinning or your philosophy that really guides you when you're, you know, making not so necessarily predictions, but, you know, how the world will be in 3 to 5 or 10 or 15 years?
there are also many types of futurists. And you know, my real focus is not so much on technology. It's on people. Because what I've noticed is that things really change when people change. You can have new technologies. You can have disruptive devices. You can have faster broadband speeds. None of that actually means anything until consumers change their behavior, until companies change their behavior, and until leaders change the way that they make decisions and do things. So I travel a lot, and I spend a lot of time in all kinds of places, from India to Brazil to Shanghai to Turkey. And what I'm looking for is, pieces of a puzzle to try and understand how some of these new disruptive technologies are interfacing with human society.
And when you're looking at like the way that people change their behaviors, and you're looking at leaders, and you're looking at companies and culture, maybe even how employees, like what's the old way of doing business, and then what's the new way that you think is going to work moving forward?
There's kind of a set model of what a 20th century company looks like, and we're quite familiar with that. It's pretty much was something that was born out of the Industrial Revolution. It was about the factory. And it was about command and control. They called it Taylorism, where you would sort of measure the time every task took and work out maximum efficiency. And this very hierarchical, siloed model of the company worked fantastically when things were predictable, when you could draw up 5 or even 10-year plans. But now we're in a time where not only are things moving so quickly that a 5-month plan starts to look ambitious, leaders are finding that the core of their business is having to change, their business models are having to change, and their customers and who their competitors are in a very fluid state. So that's almost what's happening now, is that leaders are realizing that they have to take a more fluid, agile approach to the way they organize their people.
Good. I felt like you had like a little... You're going to add one more.
I did.
Go ahead.
And what I often like to tell my clients and audiences is that they're comfortable with the idea that technology has changed and transformed their business. I mean, it's happened over the last 5 years. But the important thing to remember is that culture is still their operating system. It's the set of rules that determines how people behave, how your best people interact with each other. And really, it's the secret behind how you get to the heart of what drives 21st century productivity.
So when it comes to like being fluid to change, and I like, we've had this discussion before when we talked a few months back, but like, I come from the startup world, and it's pivot, 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 you know. Don't worry if something fails, just move, move, move. But then you have these old established companies, and they just don't understand that philosophy. They don't understand failing fast and failing forward or anything else like that. So how can we, you know, unplug ourselves and reboot with the new OS?
Well, I think the starting point is you've got to recognize how dangerous the myth of the startup is. It's become quite fashionable to tell big companies they should behave like startups. It's like telling somebody that they should lose like, you know, 50 kilos and look like a supermodel. I mean, it would be wonderful, but it can be quite disheartening when you're actually working in a company with 5,000 or 10,000 or even 20,000 people. And the problem is that when you're 5 people, like a typical startup, if you're not agile and creative and adaptive, there must be something profoundly wrong with all 5 of you. It's actually very easy to have great culture when you have a small number of people. The minute you get a critical mass of human beings together, it's strange. I mean, all best intentions aside, it's like there are these unseen cultural antibodies which spin up into place, and their sole purpose is to hunt down and identify and terminate with extreme prejudice anybody who has an original or disruptive idea. So the only way you can combat that is to take a quite deliberate approach to coding a new way of interacting.
So when you're talking about like the myth of the startup, you're saying that a startup mentality or the agility of a startup can't be applied to a large, let's say, you know, no. blue chip or Fortune 500 company. But instead, if it was a, you know, sub 150, sub, maybe a 10 person company, you know, that's where you still have the ability to be agile and proactive and set the narrative that you want your audience or your customers to hear or feel or see.
You can be agile as a big company, but you have to break yourself into smaller components. You can't just copy paste a startup's culture, because the fact is that even startups stop behaving like that after a while. You're scrappy and you're fighting over resources because that's just the reality. But at some point, you end up with a HR department because you have HR issues. You end up with processes because you can't just wing it anymore. And that's okay. That's maturity. But what's happening now is that if you look at a lot of successful companies that have managed to scale, and Amazon is a classic example, they've evolved practices that allow them to remain agile. You know, Jeff Bezos is famous for talking about his two pizza teams. So you should never have a team big enough, any bigger that can be fed with two pizzas. I was actually running a session for Amazon Seattle a couple of weeks back, and I said, look, how big are these pizzas? You know, because I've heard this. And, you know, it's a bit deceptive. I mean, how many people are we actually talking about here? And apparently it's kind of like between 4 to 8 people is sort of the critical mass for a project team. But, you know, someone like Apple will actually extend that idea even further. And there was this really interesting study on productivity, which Bain and company did. And they looked at the difference between highly productive companies like Dell, Netflix, and Apple. These companies were on average 40% more productive than normal companies. And I guess the thesis was maybe they've just hired more superstars. But it turns out that most companies have a similar distribution of very smart people. The difference is companies like Apple put all of their best people on the biggest, most existentially threatening projects. So they'll kind of put all their eggs in one basket and say, look, if this is iOS, we can't screw it up. We have to win. Let's put all of our superstars on this one project.
Mm-hmm. And if it's the Apple Watch, then they put everybody else who's like second team.
That's right.
Even though I love my Apple Watch, Apple, sorry. Go ahead.
I think, you know, these are the kinds of, you know, emerging strategies for big companies to remain agile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I saw that at the large startup that I was at, and all my friends who work for other companies like Apple or even Amazon, you know, they'll be on, it's almost like internal consulting. They'll be on a project and they'll run through the duration of the project. Maybe it's 8-9 months. And then once that comes to, you know, completion, maybe they're on the beach for a week or two, and then they get tasked out to another project. But it's taking the best components for whatever that, you know, need or project is, and then that's how they attack it.
There's a reason why this way of thinking is becoming more important, and it's because, you know, one of the key debates of the 21st century is going to be, what is work that is best done by machines? Mm-hmm. And what is work that is best done by people? You know, there's a lot of fear and hype about robots taking over human jobs at the moment. But, you know, that's not really the issue. I mean, the more interesting issue is, what is people-shaped work? And the kind of putting superstars on super problems is a classic example of things that humans are uniquely tasked to handle. And these are cognitively difficult problems that require the kind of skills which, and you know, that machines would find very difficult, you know, to handle.
You know, you mentioned like robots taking people's jobs, and, you know, there's no secret here that we do send a questionnaire out to the guest. And one of the things that you wanted to talk about was the fact that there's a lot of discussion with AI, you know, taking people's jobs. And I remember not so long ago, I was having a conversation with a lawyer, and I was like, hey, bud, you know, you may think that robots are taking like the blue collar jobs, but the reality is that AI is going to take all of the subject matter expert jobs. This is my opinion, whether it be, you know, diagnosis for doctors, or if it's, you know, someone who can read you know, natural language legalese as quickly as possible, as a, you know, machine learning algorithm can do. And so I'm wondering, you know, who should be worried, or should we be worried, or are we using these AI programs and machine learnings as an assistance for a short stopgap measure before we go full AI? How's that looking?
It's a subtle issue. I remember when I finished law school, I only spent one day in the law firm because I walked into the office and there was a partner there in a three-piece suit, and he was staring at me like a sort of a cockroach had scuttled in. And I was like, I was excited to be a lawyer. And he said, oh, good, you're here. He said, he pointed at this stack of papers and he said, you see all these papers? I said, yes. He said, look, we need these all checked for spelling immediately. And I was like, what? I said, don't you have software to do that? He said, oh, that's right, we do. It's you. And I immediately quit, you know, because I thought this is ridiculous. All these lawyers are going to be replaced by software in the next 5 years. Anyway, that was 20 years ago. And there are now more lawyers on the planet than in history. Mm-hmm. And the reason why software hasn't replaced these jobs in the way we thought is because what automation tends to do is actually create more work. It just shifts people into different roles. And I was interviewing the CIO of a big Magic Circle global law firm. And I said, aren't you worried about these algorithms automating all of these functions? He said, no, because essentially these machine learning algorithms need to learn from something. And what they're learning from is all the data from all of the transactions we've ever worked on, all of the deals we've been involved in, all of the combined knowledge and intellectual property. But you still need people to guide the learning algorithms, to interrogate them, to audit them. So people are making the shift from doing work to designing work. Sure, there's going to be a piece of software that can better diagnose a cancer skin cell than a doctor. But you're going to need doctors to help design those systems. And that's the big transformation, I think, in knowledge work.
Do you think it's going to limit the amount of individuals that are needed to go into a specific field? Let's say like a general physician or something like that, since it is mapping, it's like the experience API, you know, something that plugs in and it reads every decision point that you've ever made. And if you're plugging that data set into, you know, if you're plugging 100,000 people into that data set, you can really start to limit the amount of new doctors or lawyers, right? Or is there, am I missing something?
You may need less people with specialist knowledge. The ones that have that will be perhaps a smaller percentage of the population. But you may need more people with human caring skills and good bedside manner to break the news that the algorithms delivered to you. Mm-hmm. and one of the wonderful things I think about this revolution is that for the first time, those very soft human skills of caring, of nursing, of empathy, that have traditionally been not paid as well as the knowledge jobs, may actually start to get the premium they deserve.
That's interesting.
So it's kind of like reverting back to the way it was, you know, when you didn't have a doctor in every town, but maybe you had a bedside nurse.
Just to tell you that you have no hope. Yes, basically.
Hold my hand, take me to the light.
Well, I think that's right. You know, I'm writing a book about this at the moment, and I'm really focused on this question of what is going to be a great algorithmic leader. And, you know, for me, it is those two very important qualities. The first is, as you mentioned, Kyle, which is the empathy, you know, with the human condition, the ability to understand, connect, motivate, incentivize other human beings. Machines aren't great at that. And when they do try to do it, like the algorithm at Uber, you know, working for algorithms is not particularly fun. But the other side of, which is another key skill, which is something that most leaders don't yet have their minds around, is the ability to be proficient at computational thinking. And that's not the ability to program. It's the ability to solve and break problems down in a way like a computer would. That's very much about creating a hypothesis, about coming up with different strategies, about collecting data, about testing and getting feedback. It's a different way of thinking about strategy.
when you talk about leaders lacking this ability to have computational thinking or problem solving skills, what are I think I know what you're saying. I definitely know what you're saying, but you know what can people look for to either sharpen these computational skills, or if they're looking to hire maybe their replacement, or you know, find a partner or co-founder? You know, what are you looking for to have somebody who has, you know, robust computational problem solving skills?
The first kind of, I would say, foundational capability is a familiarity and comfort level with data. So Amazon, for example, if you want to get a decision made at Amazon, you don't bring a PowerPoint deck. In fact, PowerPoint is banned. You have to come in with a maximum 6-page memo and a stack of data appendices. And people spend the first 20 minutes of the discussion, you know, going through the data, and then they argue about it point by point. So the ability to look for data to support your decisions is probably the first skill. But, you know, beyond that, it's starting to understand the power of algorithms. You see, it doesn't matter if you work in a beverage company like Coca-Cola, or you work for a car company, or you work in manufacturing or logistics. Algorithms now are really the core of how a company creates and delivers value for its customers. There's an algorithm at FedEx, which is hundreds of pages long because it determines the scheduling and how trucks and deliveries are moved around. There's a wonderful story about the CEO of Deliveroo, which is sort of one of the leading delivery companies in the United Kingdom. And he spent the first 6 months of his job riding on a motorcycle, delivering pizzas. And it wasn't because they were short-staffed or they didn't have the venture capital to hire more drivers. It's because he wanted the situational context for understanding what are all of the variables that impact a rider's journey and that contribute to the customer experience. Because only after he was able to internalize that as a leader was he able to step back and then make strategic decisions about the algorithm that drives the value of his company.
Where do you think the divide or schism is between, you know, the comfort level and familiarity with data that I feel a lot of great leaders have versus those who just don't have that or choose not to understand what the powerful data is that they possess or own?
I think most leaders understand the value of data. In fact, we've all grown up with Excel. If anything, there's been an over-reliance on Excel-generated data. The subtle change is now we're dealing with real-time data. And coming to a meeting with a kind of a fanciful Excel projection with made-up numbers is just not a smart way to make decisions. I mean, if you're making a major decision today and you're in a big company, you should be looking at the real-time information from your operation. And you should be working with people that can create algorithms that can run what-if analysis and look at different scenarios. But it should be with real live information. And because that's the speed at which decisions need to now be made.
What are some like other kind of key issues that business leaders are facing besides, you know, maybe, you know, there's a lot of really great, you know, software platforms out there like Domo that'll give you like real time, you know, data and analytics. But besides that, you know, what are some other key issues that people, you know, maybe need to have, you know, instead of looking at the shadows on the cave wall, they need to turn to the light?
Well, the number one issue, I believe, for leaders today is transformation. Because a lot of the stuff we've been speaking about are sort of tactical changes in the development of your teams or your leaders or the way you think and handle culture. But the big overarching issue is about how you manage the new pace of change. And people talk about digital transformation as a key priority. It's interesting, when McKinsey surveyed companies about the biggest obstacles to digital transformation, number one was beliefs. People in general in large companies think that digital transformation is about upgrading your technology, But it isn't. It's about upgrading the mental software and the processes and the way your company thinks about problems. So kind of driving that agenda from the boardroom right down to the people on the warehouse floor is one of the most pressing challenges, I think, for any serious 21st century leader.
Mike, in some of your talks, I know you argue that millennials aren't that important. Why do you say that?
And watch what you say.
Yeah, I can hardly wait for the answer.
Well, let me be diplomatic about this and just say they're not as important as they were. Just by simple fact of numbers, when you look at the demographics of most countries, and I say most probably with the exception of Japan, because Japan is, well, it's kind of old now, but most countries on the planet, America included, have their vast majority of their population now non-millennial. Millennials are in the workforce. They're everywhere. They're almost 50, 60, 70% of the population. So they're not the lead indicators of the future that they were 5 or 10 years ago. The people that I believe that we should be, I would say, terrified of are 8-year-olds or younger. Because this is the generation post-2007 who didn't get their first iPhone 50 like the current generation of leaders. This is the generation that had iPhones put in their hands as babysitting devices to keep them quiet by their irresponsible parents. And as a result, they have totally changed their entire mentality of what they will expect growing up. They're going to be a generation that will be very hard to predict just the scale of their impact as consumers, as employees, as designers of the future.
Yeah, we had this conversation not so long ago. I want to say maybe back in January, where you were saying you spent a lot of time looking at them, and it's interesting because it's not just that they have the iPhone, but they're growing up in a day and time where AI is a part of their life, and it will just increasingly become much more and more and more a part of their life, and it won't be seen as weird or odd versus maybe an older millennial or someone maybe of a baby boomer generation views it as this weird encroachment into their life.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. And you could actually imagine a millennial and who's now got young kids looking at their young kids and going, where is the app for that? And essentially this new generation, which look at them like they're insane, because these kids are growing up in a post-screen, post-typing society because they've grown up talking to technology. Siri and Alexa have been the kind of default second parents for this generation. Mm-hmm. Because when their parents are away and they've got hundreds of questions, Alexa is going to be the stand-in parental. Mm-hmm. And this is going to change the way that they view technology. Technology is going to be about as interesting as running water and electricity. It's going to be just kind of a backdrop to the way things are done. Mm-hmm. But if you look closely, this is not about mobile phones at all. It's about what is it to grow up in a world where you've got a layer of machine intelligence that sits between you and every experience that you have? So you can't upload a photo to Instagram, you can't listen to a song on Spotify or watch a video on YouTube and not expect to have a profoundly different experience to anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the whole Alexa thing. I'm not a huge like Alexa fan, or I was not a huge Alexa fan until I went over to my friend's house and she has it. And like the things that she, at a basic level, has set up her Alexa to do for her are insane. And then Burger King USA, they had a commercial where they said, "Hey Alexa, where's the closest Burger King?" And they timed the commercial so that way it said, "And your closest Burger King is." You know, and then it said the miles or time and location. So, like, people are even hacking it from a marketing standpoint as well.
That's great.
there was a funny story about that. There was a young girl who was left alone by her parents, and she was a bit lonely. So she asked Alexa if she could play, and you know, then she basically asked to play dolls, and Alexa pretty much interpreted this, that the young girl needed a dollhouse. So the next morning, the parents were a little bit astonished to find there was a, you know, a very expensive dollhouse had been delivered to the door and a big bag of sugary cookies.
Gotta love Alexa. She knows what I want.
Now, of course, when they ran the story on the news that night, it then triggered hundreds of other Alexas to also order dollhouses. So we've clearly got some breathing issues.
You know, Mike, early in our conversation, you jokingly said you became the worst thing, a speaker. Well, you did become a speaker, and you're very good at it. I'm curious what you think the most rewarding part of being in the speaking industry is.
I think hands down that the part I find most interesting is the people you meet. I'm in such a privileged position to a lot of the companies that hire me are some of the world's most interesting companies with incredible missions. And I get to hear about the things that terrify them, that excite them, that they're passionate about, that their senior teams are working on. So it's like having a microscope into some of the world's smartest people and what they're doing, and the briefing calls are the best part, because that's your kind of opportunity to talk to people who would probably never bother to speak to you, that you could never get on the phone if you turned up every day with a box of chocolates and they would never see you. So what I love is you start to see the links between companies, between industries, between leaders at a very high level, which you just wouldn't see if you weren't on the road giving 100 talks a year.
Speaking of that, I know in your profile it says you travel about 300 days a year. I'm curious, is that a limit of 300 days, or what's behind that number, 300?
The secret behind that is that I like to take 2 months off a year.
I knew there was something there.
I've got a little beach house in Australia that I like to go back to and just hide and read books. And, you know, I also love the Greek islands. So I take about 60 days where I just refuse to get on a plane and have some downtime to think and read and kind of plan what's coming next. But in between, I'm constantly on the move. I'm always in different cities, countries, and seeing different things.
And you're rather cosmopolitan. Where are you today?
I'm in London today.
See,
hey Mike, are the 60 days that you take off, are those 60 days together?
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. I bet that helps really recharge you and get you ready for the busy season when it rolls around.
Exactly. No, it's a wonderful thing.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned when talking about coming into the speaking industry is that you have the opportunity to come in contact with a lot of really smart people. And in case people are wondering when they're listening to this, why this is such a good sounding podcast, it's because Mike Walsh is also a podcaster as well. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your podcast and the guests that you have on there and the topics that you discuss.
Absolutely. My podcast is called Between Worlds. And I started doing it actually initially because I was lazy. It's reasonably difficult to write something clever once a week, but I thought it would be reasonably easy to have an interesting conversation with someone once a week. It turns out it's actually very difficult to find great people to talk to. But I was meeting lots of people on my travels, and I decided rather than to do it via Skype, I would actually meet up with people in coffee shops in Paris or in Tokyo or in Silicon Valley. And I would let people sit in and listen in on the conversations I was having as I was researching my books and my talks. So I've had a very wide range of guests, everything from a guy who's a data sculptor. He's, you know, commissioned by companies like Salesforce and the LA Philharmonic to create sculptures out of pure data. Today I was interviewing the producer who created The Crown and Wallander and Outlander and a bunch of, you know, hit TV shows. I was talking to him about what it's like now being commissioned by Netflix and Amazon rather than traditional TV studios. But I also, you know, speak to crazy scientists and entrepreneurs and venture capitals. So there's no real thread for me other than people that are interesting and that are trying to come to terms with what it is to live in an algorithmic world.
Well, I mean, but at the same point in time, I mean, having this these varied viewpoints allow you to have a better informed futurism. Just trying to find the word.
Yes. That sounds like a congenital disease, but yes.
It does sound like something really horrible, doesn't it?
These are people I was talking to for research for my books anyway. I just thought I would let people listen in so that they'd realize that my information was coming from experts rather than other people's blogs.
Well, from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, I do want to wrap this up, but one of the things that we had when we talked back in January, when we were talking about technology and fun stuff, we were talking about, you know, internal communication tools like Slack or HipChat, changing the way that people communicate internally versus email and how things are changing kind of in that regard. So I'm just kind of wondering, like, if you're a small business, let's say you're 10 people, what are some things that Mike Walsh believes that you should have and a quick reason as to why from like a technology standpoint?
In truth, I don't think it particularly matters in that if you're on the cloud and you've got a fast way of working, it doesn't actually matter what your tools are anymore. And that's because all the tools are pretty much the same. What is more important is your rhythm of working. And, you know, I would say 3 years ago, it mattered a lot that you were using one tool over the others. But there's sort of a kind of an equilibrium now. Even Microsoft it's got fantastic tools now. They've kind of taken a lot of the elements of Slack and built their own Teams-based product. But what you want to do, whether you're a company of 5 people or 50 people or 5,000 people, is to get into a rhythm of constantly challenging yourself that you've identified projects that are going to move you forward, they're going to disrupt what you're doing, and that are critically important. You've got your best people working on it. You're running experiments. You're iterating. You're taking some of those elements of sort of fast production, and you're working in a way that's agile. And if you're doing that, it doesn't matter if you're using bits of paper and throwing airplanes at each other. It's just about challenging the human dynamics. You know, IBM recently ended their practice of allowing people to work from home. And this was really controversial because IBM created a lot of the technology that allowed people to work from home. But the reason why they did that is that when they looked at their most innovative projects, they were generally driven by small teams of people that were co-located in a single location. So sometimes old school is still new school.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you did mention was that being like cloud-based, and I'm a huge fan of that. And so from there, if we're just looking at kind of cloud-based solutions, doing that, generally speaking, just going cloud-based versus saving it on your computer or saving it on a server farm or something else like that makes a lot more sense.
It makes sense because it allows you to get up and focus on the work much more quickly rather than spending time trying to run an IT department when you're 5 people. But that logic applies when you're 5,000 people too. The reason why I think technology didn't significantly improve productivity for the last 10 or 15 years is we spent so much time on the technology. Technology is not important. It's a commodity. What matters is the way people interact with each other. And that's really hard.
Cool beans. Well, I think that is a good place for us to wrap. So if you would like to listen to Mike Walsh's podcast, we'll have a link of it on the GDA Podcast website, as well as the transcript and the books. So the website's gdapodcast.com. For speaker information or to book Mike for your next event, you can do so by contacting GDA Speakers. The phone number in the U.S. is +1-214-420-1999. That's for the international audience, the +1. I don't know why I remember that, but I just do. And then the website's gdaspeakers.com. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. And I know that we're planning on getting you here soon. And I look forward to that as well.
Thanks, Mike.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers. If you're interested in booking today's guest, visit GDA Speakers at gdaspeakers.com or call 214-420-1999. Visit gdapodcast.com and subscribe to our newsletter to stay up to date and be informed of new episodes, blog posts, and more. Be sure to follow GDA Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at GDA Podcast, as well as Facebook at facebook.com/GDA Podcast. Thanks again, and stay tuned for more from GDA Podcast and GDA Speakers.